Rural Development, Finance and Policy Committee to order, members. Quorum is present. For the record, members, a few bills today. Senator Pratt, we've got Senate File 3625 first on the agenda. Welcome to our committee. Chair will move SF 3625 for consideration and to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Ag Omnibus Bill. So, Senator Pratt, welcome. Tell us about your bill, and then you've got a testifier we'll want to hear from. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 3625 allocates $7 million from the general fund to create a pilot program supporting the thoroughbred industry in Minnesota while protecting over $400 million in economic contributions and 5,600 jobs in the Minnesota agricultural economy. Now, I'm going to let my testifiers get into the details because they know it more in depth. But in essence, we're looking for a short 2-year pilot that will put $5 million into a thoroughbred residency program modeled after after similar programs in other states that incents owners to keep their horses in Minnesota, $1 million for retaining and repurposing retired thoroughbreds, and $1 million in support of mental health and educational services for local communities and stable workers. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd entertain any questions, or I'll go to the testifier, whatever you prefer.
Why don't we start with the testifier, Senator Pratt, Joe Skirto. Joe?
That's correct.
Welcome. Identify yourself for the record.
We're trying to square this all up technology-wise.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. I'll introduce myself. I'm Joe Skirto, president of the Minnesota Thoroughbred Racing Alliance, former deputy director of the Minnesota Racing Commission, and executive director of the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project. Thank you for hosting me today. I'll start by sharing the screen with the presentation. The bill you have in front of you provides the opportunity to attract and keep more thoroughbred horses in Minnesota, accelerate economic and agricultural benefits to the state, and provide support services to the community and those who care for these equine athletes. Agriculture in Minnesota has traditionally been focused on cows, pigs, and chickens. One of our goals is to make thoroughbreds as important in our state's economy as any other livestock or agricultural product. In the horse racing world, thoroughbreds can be viewed as mobile sports franchises. Several ingredients go into an owner's decision where to race their horses: money available, purses, conditions for their workers, stable area services, access to professional veterinary services, and quality agricultural products all are part of the mix. Traditionally, a state's breeding program provided a home team for racetracks. These were the horses that were given incentives to race in the state in which they were born. Unfortunately, due to the uncertainty of future economic conditions, the transition of wagering to mobile platforms, the loss of breeding farms, and the recent COVID-19 pandemic, the amount of money available for breeder incentives is in decline. The result has been the number of thoroughbred foals born in Minnesota has dropped by almost 2/3. Minnesota horse racing produces over $400 million in annual economic activity. A thoroughbred racehorse that spends a summer racing at Canterbury will cost an owner an average of $15,000, plus the costs of transportation getting to Minnesota, the capital investment of purchasing or raising the horse. Canterbury Park, along with its racing participants, also pay to provide a stable area that includes housing, education, and health services to the people that come here each year to take care of the horses. The number of jobs and size of the labor force connected to thoroughbred horse racing is often underestimated or simply not on the radar of most legislators or chambers of commerce. The diversity of skill levels and commitment to the jobs performed by all the cogs in the wheel is inspiring. The job centered around the horse is only part of the picture. There is also all the labor committed to making sure the public has an entertaining day at Canterbury Park. This combination makes horse racing a powerful economic engine for both agriculture and business in Minnesota. In addition to the jobs produced, the impact on agriculture and the products consumed, all of which are produced or distributed right here in Minnesota, is substantial. The average thoroughbred will consume 25 pounds of feed a day. On any given day, you can see trailer loads of hay, feed, bedding, and other products being delivered to the Canterbury Park stable area. You will also see trailers hauling horses, veterinary trucks going barn to barn, and food trucks stationed to serve our people. The pilot program in front of you has been designed to increase demand for local agricultural products and grow the need for supportive services like veterinary care, transportation, and retail supplies. Additionally, it creates additional jobs and equine-related educational internships, supports mental health, both for the industry and general community, and provides ESL programs and summer school for children and adults in our primarily immigrant stable area community. This one-time appropriation will create a program that will become self-sustaining by way of its own success. By the state providing a launching pad, more thoroughbreds will come to Minnesota. More will race, more races will be run, and in turn, more money will be available to fund future incentives. This is a true agricultural and economic stimulus bill. How does the program actually work? First, it requires any thoroughbred racehorse to spend a minimum of 120 days in Minnesota. Once that's been achieved, they will become Minnesota certified by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Once certified, each racehorse would receive a $750 stipend for each race it competes in until their racing career is over. It will also make the horse eligible to participate in our aftercare programs designed to keep these horses in the state for the rest of their lives. Other states like Virginia and Delaware have seen success with similar programs. We base the length of stay for eligibility and incentives in the middle of what these states have offered to provide a strong, tested foundation for this pilot program. The payoff is getting more horses to come to Minnesota. Last year, there were 1,100 thoroughbreds residing in the stable area at Canterbury Park. Unfortunately, the current trend shows that number dropping to 900 within the next 2 years. With this program, we can reverse the trend and look to bringing 1,500 horses into the state each year, and along with it, a $60 million positive economic impact. Not only do we want horses to come race in Minnesota, but we also want them to stay as they move on to their next career. The pilot program in front of you provides $500,000 in annual grants from the Department of Agriculture available to nationally accredited organizations, Racing Commission approved groups, and Minnesota colleges and universities that have equine programs doing this work. A typical thoroughbred racehorse will retire from racing by age 7. The average lifespan of a thoroughbred is 25 years. That means a thoroughbred will have 18 years in a different capacity. An owner of a retired thoroughbred will have annual expenditures of $7,500 and thus expend over $135,000 during its lifetime. When we keep our thoroughbreds here in Minnesota, it will support agribusiness, secure open space, and simply make Minnesota better. As you can see by the map, the footprint of where these horses are currently preparing for their next career is expanding and will eventually touch all corners of the state. Not only does this pilot program support agriculture, but it also has a very real human element. Thoroughbred-based mental health programs, some of which are happening right now at Canterbury Park, are proving highly effective in saving lives of people struggling with PTSD, addiction, and depression. To support the success of our immigrant workforce, the industry has established ESL and summer educational programs for children and adults working or residing at Canterbury Park. The funding associated with this program will expand their ability to provide more services to more people, both on the track and throughout the state. We have worked diligently to create a program that benefits Minnesotans, Minnesota agribusiness, and an industry that is desperately in need for a leg up to continue to be a vibrant and exciting industry well into the future. From all of us, we thank you for your consideration, and I'll stand to take any questions.
Thank you, sir. We certainly appreciate your testimony. Members, any questions for either Senator Pratt or the testifier? Members, any questions? Senator Pratt, would you like to make some final comments on Senate File 3625?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing this bill. Entertainment is a key industry down in Scott County. We have Valley Fair, Canterbury, Mystic Lake, Renaissance Festival. We draw in millions of visitors every year. And places like Canterbury are not just places to put down a pari-mutuel bet. They're a key economic driver in our community. In fact, Canterbury will employ over 1,500 people throughout the year. And that's a lot of jobs that we have down there. The other reason, you know, it's not by accident that Scott County became the home for Canterbury. And I was just telling Senator Eakin before the hearing that when I was growing up and Scott County was much, much smaller than it is today, I remember a stat that we had more horses per capita in Scott County than any other county in Wyoming at the time. And so it's always been in our blood. It's always been a part of our culture down in Scott County. And we love having Canterbury. We love having the horsemen be a part of our economy. This is good for jobs. This is good for the community. And I appreciate the committee's time on it.
Members, Senator Western renews his motion to lay Senate File 3625 over for possible inclusion. Members, the next bill we have is Senator Johnson's Senate File 3854.
Get out of your way. Fun stuff.
Senator Johnson, welcome to the Agricultural Rural Development Finance Policy Committee. I think we've seen you here for several different times, and that's great. Welcome back. Today we have Senator Johnson's white-tailed deer farmers compensation policy or compensation bill. I see we have several testifiers. Members, in your packets, there's also some printed material from people that wanted to testify through that media. With the number of testifiers we have, I would appreciate it if the testifiers could limit their comments to around that 2 minutes. So with that said, this bill will be laid over, right? So with that said, the Senator Dornick moves that Senate File 3854 be passed and laid over for possible inclusion. We start out, Senator Johnson, would you comment on Senate File 3854?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's very good to be here in front of you again today, this large crowd of senators that we have before us. So thank you for the opportunity to present 3854. So this gets to be a bit of a controversial subject, I understand that. And you know, whether you agree with deer farming or you don't agree with deer farming, in my opinion, we got to look to what has happened to the industry as far as what our responsibility is as a government to what has happened to that industry. Now, if we bear some responsibility, we also bear some of the expenses, too, I feel, for what we are doing, what the agencies are doing to the industry itself. Much like we saw during COVID with the PPP loans and the, you know, we had Minnesota businesses shut down here, restaurants and theaters and whatnot. And we came and provided some support for those businesses as well. Well, they face a very similar situation in that because of some of the actions that were made at DNR, that they could not any longer transport those animals. And I think that we have bear some responsibility to ensure that some minimum costs in order to at least have them, these are families, these are small businesses, at least have them be in a position where they shouldn't be much worse off because of the things that we have done. So with that, I do have two testifiers with me today, Stan Tweed and Mr. Sprecht, who is here on behalf of the Deer Farmers Association.
So, Mr. Sprecht, would you like to state your name and who you represent?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Tim Sprecht, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Deer Farmers Association. Mr. Chair, this bill is really critical. Even if it's passed, it's going to in no way make these folks whole. They've suffered an awful lot financially, emotionally, and what we're trying to do is help them through a very difficult time that really has the industry on the brink. So to predicate my comments about this bill, number 3854, I want you to think of these six words, and those words are through no fault of their own. This bill is based on compensating for losses that were suffered by a legitimate agricultural industry through no fault of their own. So what we're addressing here today are two things. We're addressing DNR no movement zones, and we're addressing Board of Animal Health endemic zones. So the Board of Animal Health endemic zones come about when deer is found to have chronic wasting disease in the wild. Now, this is not on the farm, this is in the wild. At that point, the DNR essentially drops a pin and says a 15-mile radius around that is now considered an endemic zone. The Board of Animal Health adopts that. And what that does is it literally traps a farming industry within that 15-mile radius. It does not allow them to move any of their animals. Now, these zones are splattered throughout the state, and if you folks paid attention to the news in the last couple days, now we've got a brand new wild CWD deer found in the Grand Rapids area. There have never been any there before, and now all of a sudden we've got another zone. So picture these round 15-mile radius endemic zones around the state, and eventually the entire state's going to be shut down. No movement, no ability to conduct commerce in any meaningful way. The second thing that we're addressing in this bill is the DNR no movement zones. Now, the DNR, three times in the last 3 years, has under the, I want to say pretense, but that's not the correct word, but the DNR has determined that there was a danger to the wild herd population for whatever reason, and they have essentially shut the entire state of Minnesota down to any whitetail movement, which captures every single deer farm. No movement. Last time they did it was in the fall. This is what the deer farmers consider to be their harvest time. This is when they make their profit for the year. There was no movement, so they were not allowed to move any animals to hunting preserves. There were a number of very lucrative hunts that were planned from out of state folks coming in. They couldn't move breeding stock. They couldn't move any deer at all. And once again, through no fault of their own, they were put on the shelf at the most important time of year. And the losses are real. They're substantial, and there are people that are on the edge, and you're going to hear from just a few today, and I would also encourage you to look at the written testimony that we have. So, Mr. Chair, I have other notes here I'm not going to go into in the interest of time. And also, this bill has had a hearing in the House, and assuming that it does move and that it does move in the Senate, I think what we'd like to do is address some of the other issues that are included within the bill to try and consolidate in terms of language and dollar amount. But today, my job is to bring before you people that have real, quantifiable, and devastating losses and let them speak from their heart to the committee. Mr. Chair, I will be available for questions if needed.
Well, thank you, Mr. Spreck. And members, we'll hold questions till we get through the testifiers, and then we'll open up for questions. So if the testifiers, if you'd hang around that way, if there are some questions. Next, we have Stan and Fran Vett. And if you folks would come to the presenter's chair.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I should have said your name too.
That's good. I'm good.
Welcome, folks, to the Agricultural and Rural Development Finance and Policy Committee. We certainly appreciate your coming in today, and we certainly want to hear your testimony. If you would go ahead and each state your name, who you represent, and then proceed to the testimony, we would appreciate it. So whichever would like to go first.
Hello, my name is Stan Tweet.
My name is Fran Tweet, and I'm not going to apologize for us being emotional because it's a hard time. Thank you for letting us speak today. We really appreciate it. We're under a lot of stress. Stan and I have been farming since we were kids. We grew up on farms. We had a dairy farm for years. We lost it to stray voltage and from a lightning strike. Mother Nature took us out. We had to start all over again with three teenage children and a baby. We had nothing. My husband is the hardest working, oddest man I ever met. He built our new farm with his own hands, spending thousands of hours of backbreaking work. We have had many successful hunts with hunters coming all the way from the East Coast. They love our farm. The movement ban has caused hunters to back out from the already booked hunts. The movement ban also prevented us from buying additional bucks to stock our preserve. The financial damage has been severe, and we struggled day by day to pay the bills. We can't plan on any improvements or maintenance right now because we don't know what the heavy hand of the DNR is going to do to us. The DNR doesn't plan to regulate us. They want to destroy us. When our farm is destroyed, we will have absolutely nothing. My husband and I both have stress-related health issues, and if we will be forced to sell our home and our land, as our minimal Social Security will not allow us to live there. I would ask you that you would please help us. Give us some relief from the hostile DNR.
When you drive in my yard, you'll see three crosses. Sorry. You'll see three crosses. When you get to the top of my driveway, you're going to see the American flag. I never dreamt in my lifetime I'd have to fight my own government. I thought we were the land of the free and the home of the brave. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, folks, very much for your touching testimony. We certainly do appreciate it, and it's unfortunate that you have these type of issues. Thank you very much. Next, we have Steve Porter. Welcome to the committee, Steve. I know you've been here before. Appreciate your coming back again. If you would state your name for the record and who you represent, and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure, thank you for having me. My name is Steve Porter. I'm a deer farmer up in Northwest Minnesota. I just retired from law enforcement. I've served as deputy, chief deputy, and sheriff. During the last 30 years, I also built a white-tailed deer farm. I want to point something out here, too, that's critical. In the beginning of my career in law enforcement, I would respond to 911 calls. It became part of my nature when people were struggling and having trouble. I put on my duty belt and my uniform, and I responded with all the tools that were available to help victims. Throughout this crisis in the deer farm industry, my phone's been ringing off the hook. People know to call me. My wife won't go out on a date with me because she says you're on the phone the whole entire time we're gone. My phone rings steady from people like Stan and Fran who are concerned. I've faced a lot of chaos in my life. The chaos that's before us right now in this deer industry, it's incredible. If I talk about what the DNR has done, the three movement bans that they did, were devastating to me and my one boy specifically, who's building a farm on my farm. He's built a house on my farm. He wanted to take over my farm for 30 years. The first movement ban was illegal on its face. The first movement ban was, it wasn't legal. It shut me down. It cost me a lot of money. I had to break contracts. There was deceitful language published at the state register's office. Then eventually the DNR gets co-authority, and they've came after us with a full force and vengeance of a law enforcement agency. I've discussed in this same room how it's unconstitutional to send law enforcement officers into private farms like Stan and Fran. It's unconstitutional. I know it as a former sheriff, and every sheriff I've spoke to knows that you cannot send an officer to private property without a search warrant, without consent, but that's exactly what's happening, stressing out these farmers. The movement bans caused me to force breakage of contracts. I have the contracts. I could show them to you at a later date. Sports show promoters, I couldn't go. I couldn't appear at the shows. I have other sports show promoters that won't let me come now because they fear that there will be another movement ban. They fear that it's coming. So why hire Steve so he can break his contract with us right before the event? So not only have I lost existing contracts, I've lost future contracts due to the heavy hand of the Minnesota DNR. And when I say heavy hand, I'm not just using that as a term. I want to point something out. We're in an egg committee right here. If we have TB show up in cows, we quarantine the infected cow herd and any cow herd that had contact with it. The Board of Animal Health does a great job. But what the DNR does, once they got their co-authority, they sweep with a broad brush. If CWD shows up on one farm, they arbitrarily shut the whole entire state down. They're hostile, and they know they're hostile, and they don't care. Why should I be shut down when I'm enrolled in a CWD monitoring program that is recognized by the USDA, it's recognized by the Minnesota Board of Animal Health? I have clean animals. It's a recognized state and federally certified, scientifically approved program. I don't have CWD, but yet I'm shut down. These hostile actions by the state are causing a lot of harm to farmers. Another thing, if I want to prove that the DNR is hostile, please go on their website for CWD management to look at their co-authority that they have. They have chosen to, for the face of the agency that they represent, they have chosen to put a lactating doe. A doe on my farm may have twins or triplets, and then they community nurse. I might have one doe that nurses five or six fawns. She'll hold still for all of them. It doesn't even matter who their mom is. Does in June are particularly thin. Their ribs will show and so will their hips. So what does the DNR do? They put a picture of a lactating doe on the front of their program to show the public how our animals are thin and suffering. I ask you, I beg you this question. Would the Board of Animal Health, would they take a cow with pink eye, an infected eye, and put that on the top of their webpage to disgrace the cattle farmers in the state of Minnesota? They wouldn't do that. We've got thousands of beautiful pictures of white-tailed deer that we could have put for them to use, but their goal isn't to work with us. Their goal is to run us over, to embarrass us, to humiliate us, and to run us out of business. That is the goal of the Minnesota DNR. I'm convinced. My phone lights up every day. People are suffering, like Stan and Fran. And so I told you in the beginning that I worked in law enforcement. I responded to 911 calls, that I put on my duty belt, and I took the equipment that was necessary to go to help victims of crime. What I'm asking you today is to receive my testimony here as a 911 call. I can't do anything about it. I'm incapable. I can only use my voice. I'm asking you to hear my call as a 911 call and rescue this industry. Please respond, because you're all that we have. This industry will not survive if it's left in the hands of the Minnesota DNR. Let me repeat, this industry will not survive. They've infiltrated the Board of Animal Health with Jim Vaught illegally sitting on the board. They've got co-authority. They're violating landowner rights by sending licensed officers to farms. You would not allow a licensed officer to go to a pig farm or a cattle farm or a turkey farm, but somehow it makes sense to put a law enforcement agency over a deer farm. It makes no sense to me. Co-authority has to be stopped in its tracks. It's got to be stopped. And if you fail to do that, you can say goodbye to all the deer farms in Minnesota. They will not survive till next fall. Our industry will be dead if it's left in the hands of the Minnesota DNR. They've demonstrated that they're going to be hostile, and they're proud of it. I'm calling 911 for help. Please hear our cries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Porter. Members, next testifier we have is Deb Holtoss by Zoom. Deb, are you there? Please identify yourself for the record, and you may begin, Deb. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us, and thank you for listening to our testimonies. My name is Deb Holtoss. I will give you a little bio of myself. I am a farmer by birthright. I was born and raised on a farm. We've continued to farm as through my marriage, and now I'm much older and I'm still farming. You can take the girl off the farm, but you can't take the farm out of the girl. We've raised beef cattle, dairy cattle, horses, swine. Our new endeavor is white-tailed deer. We've been in that industry for about 12 years now. We've also raised corn, soybeans, alfalfa, potatoes. We do aerial application for crops, pasture, and forestry. So we're very invested with the Department of Agriculture in all of these endeavors, and specifically invested with the Board of Animal Health. My story today is to give example of how we've been harmed in the last ban movement that was put
Deb, can you try to get just a little closer? We can hear you, but sure. It might come through a little better even.
My testimony is to give way to the ban movement that was put on by the Minnesota DNR Commissioner in October of 2021, and why we're asking for deer farmer compensation. One day before the ban movement came on, that we had no idea was going to come on, we had 70% of our herd sold, with the other 30% on a contingency. That figure is a six-figure digit for my farm. The ban movement came on the day the trailers were in the farm and the labor was there to load the trailers. We were stopped, dead. We could not go. So we reached out. Our movement was going to be an interstate movement, which you think would be simple because the ban movement was an intrastate movement. But we were going to the Dakotas. We reached out to the Dakota Department of Agriculture. They would not accept our deer because of the DNR's ban movement by Minnesota. They just weren't going to take it. They said the DNR of Minnesota needs to figure out what's going on. You can talk to them. Well, talking to the Minnesota DNR in our area is not really friendly. We've had similar encounters to what the tweets have mentioned and Mr. Porter of hostile DNR interaction on our farm. But this sale was not to happen. And now what happened through the winter months, now I'm sitting with about 40% more deer on my farm than what I do every other year. My feed has increased significantly. My labor has increased. The maintenance with the winter snow and keeping these deer on my farm has increased. I couldn't put up more pens in October now that they pulled it. Much less afford to put up three or four more pens to house these deer for the year, much less pay for the additional labor. We have went to maxing out credit cards to pay for feed and labor. The stress is immense, because now we're feeding and we're having to do this in the winter months with all the snow. The other 30% of our herd that was going to be sold, that contingency came off the table, and here we are. I have to get my notes. The other thing that's happened is with the large quantity of deer we're now holding, our pastures are stressed. Now I have to look at new ways to clean up pastures in the spring. The cellars, I have to look for other cellars. And now we're gonna fawn. My does are gonna give me 2 to 3 fawns, which increases my herd. I am a CWD certified grower under the Minnesota standards and the USDA standards. I'm TB accredited. I am brucellosis accredited. I have every accreditation possible for a clean herd. Our farm is a model farm for some of the new redundant fencing that was put in. We did that because we raised cattle. We thought this just made sense, and this is how we raised our deer. So we're a model farm. We're a closed herd, which means all the deer on my farm have been born on my farm. CWD is not in my farm. If I do have the death of an animal, they are CWD tested immediately by the standards of the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. We have inventory that's annually inspected. It's registered with the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. We are doing all the protocols in place that need to be done. And yet I was banned from moving our deer herd, and my financial livelihood is now at stake. So we're asking for this compensation package, not to get ahead in deer farming, but to pay for the wrongs that we've experienced financially by a state institution. I too have 4 flags flying on my farm, American flags, and never did I think I would have to defend my farm in this manner by the hands of a state agency with this much force upon us. Thank you for your consideration. I'll stay on for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Holtoss. Appreciate your testimony. Members, questions? Senator Johnson, is there anybody else you know of that wants to testify? I think that's the end of the list.
Mr. Chair, that's all I have.
Okay. Questions, members? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Mr. Speck could answer this question. What would you say the gross amount of money that are in deer herds across the state of Minnesota? What would you estimate from your vantage point?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator, are you looking for the annual sales value of the industry as a whole?
Correct.
The figures that I've been showed are somewhere around $24-25 million per year in annual revenue for the Minnesota deer farming industry.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson,
is that's a gross estimate for all?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. And Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Speck. And so with these bans that were put in place, how many of that, say, $24 to $25 million were lost? I hear some lost this much. What would you say that the total amount was lost across the spectrum of these deer herds?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Speck.
Senator Anderson, we had our annual convention last weekend down in Austin, and there were a number of deer farmers there, and we kind of compared notes, and I listened very attentively. You know, with the stippling throughout the state of the Board of Animal Health endemic zones, which last a minimum of 3 years, plus the DNR putting on no movement zones statewide, you know, it's not inconceivable to come up with a figure somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 million of lost revenue per year. So. And of course, that's just a arbitrary shot in the dark number based on conversations I've had. But we have to remember that this goes back 3 years, 2019 through 2021.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson?
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Holtoss, question I've got for you, and then Senator Dornick has a question for one of the testifiers, but. Can you tell me a little more about your deer? You said you were just about, or you had them sold, and then you couldn't move them. Is there a chance you can sell them again, or when you sell them, are they going to a game farm where they're going to be ultimately slaughtered or butchered?
Some of both. Some of it will be breeding, and some of it will be hunts. It will be both. The challenge we're running into now is other states accepting Minnesota deer because of the hostile actions and the misinformation the Minnesota DNR has put out regarding CWD in the fence. We're fighting so many levels here. So we've tried to rekindle these sales. We're working on it. Nothing has happened as of yet.
So Ms. Holtus, are you able to recover some of that by selling them, but you've had extra added costs now because you've had to hold them? Or are those sales pretty much voided and not possible, so you'd have to find a new market? And so is part of that permanent damage, or is it all permanent damage?
Some of that is permanent damage, because in the time frame of when they could have sold in October, it was about October 1st, to when I may get them sold, I'm going to have lost livestock during that time. That's just the way it is. They don't all live. I will lose revenue. I could have a buck that's worth $7,500 that was in this original sale that just one day is dead.
Sure.
So that is a risk that I'm still managing. Like I said, we're still trying to rekindle these sales. The situation is, as it's been pointed out, our harvest time is fall. That's when we move deer. So it will depend on what I can get done between now and next October, and if we have another movement ban come on, or I might get in a 15-mile radius of this pinged area that the DNR says that there's a CWD wild animal. I mean, I have a lot of risk out here now that I might not get anything done.
Sure. Senator Dornick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a comment first. Just appreciate seeing Mr. Porter and Mr. and Mrs. Tweed here testifying. I know you drive quite a ways, but I do have a question for Mr. Porter, if he'd come up to the table.
Mr. Porter.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I missed the part where you talked about a monitoring program. Can you explain that, just about how that works? I know it was approved by many, but just a little bit more details on how that works.
Sure. So the Minnesota Board of Animal Health.
Mr. Porter.
Yes. There we go. The Minnesota Board of Animal Health has a CWD monitoring program, which means I've been in it for probably since its inception, 15 years, I'm guessing. I have to send in the brainstem and the lymph nodes on every deer that I butcher, that harvest, or dies. They are sent to the Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab at the University of Minnesota, where there is a USDA certified and approved test. And then if once we're enrolled in the program, then they say, well, Steve, you've tested 150 animals and they don't have CWD. You've sent in 150 brainstems. So since it's such a highly contagious disease and you're on one property, we know that through your high rate of testing that the rest of your animals don't have CWD. So this is recognized by the USDA as a certified test. It's been in existence forever. Meanwhile, the Minnesota DNR and some other people are pushing for us to use an RT quick test once or twice a year. Well, RT quick is experimental and it's not a certified test. And they want us to use an experimental test. And I got an email from Linda Glazier at the Board of Animal Health. I could pull my phone out and turn it on and read it to you. But basically what it says is that if they were to accept the RT quick test that's being pushed for by the DNR to test twice a year, that there would be some negative actions. They would be removed from credible federal agencies as not being a credible institution. That's what it says, and I could forward that to you afterwards, or you can get a hold of Linda Glazier and get the exact wording on it. So here they're pushing an RT quick test, which is not reliable, but again, it goes to show the hostility. I'm in a certified program, and so I get to start every conversation with, as these other people do, hey, I have a clean herd. I have a clean, healthy herd. But yet when the DNR is testifying against us, they're testifying about nonsense and saying, well, there was tracks, rubs, and scrapes on the outside of the fence. We know there's nose-to-nose contact, and we're concerned. That's a risk venue. I have a clean herd. It's not a risk venue. They're ignoring the science. The science is my herd is clean, and it's recognized. So if we were to implement RT quick, it would be devastating to some state agencies. They'd lose credibility. And also, our RT quick would cause me, but again, to show the hostility, it would cause me to work my deer twice a year through a chute. It would cause me to run deer down a hallway. I'd end up with broken legs, broken necks. I'd have increased veterinary bills. I'd have pregnant does in a chute giving me abortions. It would be so problematic. For what? To use an experimental test. They know it's experimental. They don't care. Increase our costs, decrease our revenue, stay the course, we're all run out of business. They know exactly what they're doing. Increase our cost, decrease our revenue, and we won't be in business very long. We need your help.
Senator Dornick.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Dornick.
So of all those tests, did you have any positive tests?
No, I have not had any positive, and that's a very good question. I don't have positive tests. Stan and Fran don't have positive tests. If any of us were to have a positive test, we would immediately be under quarantine by the Board of Animal Health, immediately. All the farms that we've sold to or bought from would be under quarantine. It goes out like a spider web. It is such an effective system that the Board of Animal Health has in place. It's effective, and it stops CWD in its tracks. So on the last movement ban, I think the Board of Animal Health had already had a farm under quarantine that had bought a trace back from the farm in Wisconsin. And the DNR comes on board and says, we're not happy, and we're not going to tell the Board of Animal Health, our partner. We're just going to do a statewide shutdown for 18 months. Nobody sells anything for 18 months. And then Bob Meyer sat in this chair, and he testified that it was necessary to do the ban in a surprise manner, and not tell the Board of Animal Health because he was worried deer farmers would move deer under the wire. Are we outlaws, you guys, or are we honest, upstanding American farmers? What are we? I'm tired of being treated like an outlaw, but that's how we're treated. We don't move deer under the wire. We don't want disease. We test our animals. We're honest. They've alluded that we switch tags out. In this room, they've alluded that we switch tags and make sales under the wire, and we don't tell people. That's ridiculous.
Senator Goggin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, on our testifiers list, I don't see the DNR on here. Were they invited to this committee, or?
Senator Goggin, anybody here in the DNR, you have a question for them? I see Commissioner Peterson's here. He got the same notice the DNR got, so we're not, but anybody in the DNR? They had notice of this publicly like everybody else, Senator Goggin. It doesn't appear like they showed up. Nope. Senator Goggin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's probably a question I don't know if anybody here at the committee can answer, but, you know, we talk about the transmission of CWD. I guess my question is how is it transferred in the wild? Can mice or rodents or squirrels, rabbits, birds, can they pick up the prions and drop them inside of a deer farm? I don't know. I'm just speculating at this point. So I see, yep. Mr. Porter has his hand up. I think he might be able to answer this for me.
Mr. Porter,
sure,
to that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There have been many epidemiology reports that they do an investigation when CWD breaks out. These reports are available, but the DNR doesn't like to talk about them because if they exonerate a deer farm, we'll just kind of hide it. So in one case, there was CWD brought onto a farm. The guy did have deer, but it was brought on through a taxidermy practice. He brought a deer in from Wisconsin, and the meat was fed to cats. The prions will survive the intestinal tract of a carnivore, and then they go to the bathroom on the landscape, it grows new vegetation, and the prions can be spread. The prions can hitchhike in the belly of a wolf. So when we have lots of wolves ravishing the northern part of our state, a wolf can eat an infected deer in Wisconsin. Wolves that are looking for mates that are going to disperse and travel, they're known to go up to 200 miles with a belly full of meat, and they can do it in just a couple days. These wolves go to the bathroom, and we got more problems. And meanwhile, the DNR's answer is to shut down people like Stan and Fran from making a business and take their income away. All the while, they're enrolled in a CWD program that's USDA recognized. So CWD, we still, an eagle can pick it up and fly with it. Was your question? Yes.
Senator Goggin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that answer. I'm just trying to understand how this is being looked at. And I can't speak with the DNR not here. I can only speculate. But from the testimony today, it sounds like to me the DNR immediately says CWD is a result of the deer farms. Would that be a correct statement, Mr. Porter?
They've been saying that for 5 years. It started out as a media campaign to run us out of business, and they haven't let up one bit. And there's just a handful of people. The DNR is full of wonderful, good people. There's just a handful of people that are steering the ship.
Mr. Chair, I have no further questions. Thank you.
Other questions, members? Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank everybody who's here testifying and sharing their stories. And this is a place where we experience a lot of emotion. And I'm grateful that you're here and sharing yours, even though it's very painful. It helps us focus and understand what it is that you're contending with. Mr. Chair and Senator Goggin, I can't, I wouldn't dream of getting anywhere near speaking for the DNR, and I don't know why they're not here today. But I do think it is, I think we can discern on our own from the science how CWD is spread. And whether there is intention or not on the part of the DNR, I can't imagine that they would intentionally do as you're describing, but whether there is intention or not, I think it's on us as a committee to figure out how we're going to wrestle with this issue in front of us, what people are losing in fear, what they're in fear of losing, and what we need to do about CWD. I think we understand that science, and we're in a position to be able to do something, and I'd like to do that with you and with this committee.
Thank you, Senator Murphy. Other questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Spreck, or to any other, what I heard today that both of your herds and others in the packets are clean. They've been tested. It's an ongoing, and you've been in business for years. What is the percentage, Mr. Spreck, of infected herds that have been found or been made known to? What percentage? Are they 10%, 1%, 0.1%? Your thoughts.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator Spreck. Anderson, I'm going to grapple with this, and then I'm going to let Mr. Porter fill in the blank. So the way things are done in deer farming, if there is a positive deer on a farm, the farm is immediately quarantined. USDA comes in and does their indemnity work, and it is depopulated by statute. The percentage of positives has been extremely low. When I first started working for the deer farmers, there were about 250 plus individual family farms. That number has now dropped to about 150. And not because they've been positive with CWD, but because they've been forced out of business because of the heavy hand of government crushing them. And it's a trend that's continuing. In the last 2 years, I am familiar with one positive CWD farm. That was the one in Beltrami that made a lot of news about a year ago. We immediately condemned the actions of that individual farmer. The person did not act properly. The DNR came in, erected a bunch of fences. But by statute, that farmer was put out of business. So maybe Mr. Porter can fill in the blanks. But in the 5 years I've been working with the deer farmers, I think I can count maybe three farms that went positive and were depopulated.
So, Mr. Porter?
Thank you.
Mr. Members, Chair. We do have two more bills, but I don't want to cut off testimony, but I try to be as succinct as we can.
Thank you. So, I think there were two cases in the wild, one in Polk County, Minnesota, and one now recently in Grand Rapids. These are wild deer that have no connection to a deer farm. So what is the percentage? It's extremely low. However, if we cross the border into Wisconsin, I saw a study, and I'm going by memory here, since 2002 to about a year ago, there were about 8,400 positive cases of CWD was the study I'd recently read, and they'd figured they were testing less than 10% of the deer harvested. So if we extrapolate that number forward, roughly, I think it was 8,400, and they'd tested less than 10% since 2002, what number of deer had, of those harvested, had deer with CWD in Wisconsin? It was upwards of 80,000, and that was of the harvested deer. So right across our state line in Dane, Richland, Iowa, and Sauk counties, we've got the epicenter of CWD. It's full of it. And they walk across the river. They come into Minnesota. Wolves can get a belly full and move across. CWD is prevalent in some part of the place, state. We don't know why. But the Minnesota deer farmer is not the villain. We are not the villain. And we've been made out to be a villain. Thank you.
Follow-up, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Porter. Thank you, Mr. Spratt.
Thank you.
Senator Frentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Johnson, for bringing this forward. Thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Tweet. We have witnesses come here for a lot of different reasons, and the ones that show emotions are the ones that care, and I won't forget your testimony. I had sort of a question for you, Senator Johnson. You're a reasonable guy trying to get stuff worked out. Can we get the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association sort of together with our deer farmers? Do we have any peace in the valley? I mean, is that a group that can help us find a solution that will make people happy? We have the agency, you know, the DNR. That's the other branch. We're the legislative branch. So, I mean, we can deal with that. But Deer Hunters is one of the constituencies that, you know, has an interest too. Senator Johnson, we'll put them together maybe, or what's the story there? I have not heard from them.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Frentz, you're always trying to find peace in the valley, and I appreciate that about you. You're also a very reasonable man. For this particular question, you know, there are, have been discussions between the two. I think they are not necessarily seeing eye to eye on all aspects of this particular realm. But within this bill, if we just focus straight on this bill, this doesn't have to do with the politics behind it and what's going on. I think this is simply compensation for the actions that have happened in the past. So if we get back straight to this bill, I think we could probably find some common ground.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Frentz.
Thank you for the extra time. It's an important issue. I'm just signaling if there's peace in the valley, we should look for it. Thank you, Senator Johnson. Count on us to work together if there's some way to boost that process. Thank you.
Senator Johnson, Mr. Spreck, something that we can continue to work with on that. I think anything we can do to be helpful, but the deer hunters are also deer hunters, and sounds like some of the hunting preserves hunt deer, so they probably do some of that activity as well. So it'd be nice to see a resolution or some reasonable solutions here, because these are just as important as the specialty crop farmers, as the livestock farmers that we're trying to help with the drought relief. This is a niche market we've developed here in Minnesota. I think a lot of the farmers that have gotten into this that I've talked with have, you know, found this niche. And Senator Frentz, I know you share the same aspirations that we have all the variety of options in agriculture, and we don't need just soybean farmers or just dairy farmers or just corn farmers. Most farmers are resilient and find ways to fill a niche in the marketplace, and It's very unfortunate what we've been hearing. Members, if I can just refresh our memories a little bit. When we had an earlier hearing, again, I wish the DNR was here. If they've come in, please come forward. They had the same notice everybody else did. It's very unfortunate they didn't show up. But if to the last question, Senator Anderson, I remember the testifier, one of the doctors, I think it was from the DNR, from memory, I'm thinking they said about a third to half of the deer in Wisconsin they felt were probably CWD positive, if I remember the testimony right. If some of you guys remember that as well. But lastly, we brought this bill forward, members. There's struggling. There's hurting family farms out there. If you recall, the DNR did tell us, and they told me in a private meeting first, but they told us in committee that they did not tell the Board of Animal Health, their co-equal partner, about this till the night before this movement order in, because they thought they might go tell the deer farmers. And that, to me, is a pretty intentional harm that was trying to be caused by a state agency. And members, I think it's helpful that we shine lights on this. And there needs to be actions that we hold our agencies responsible. They should be working for us, the taxpayers, and the legislative branch. And so I don't know what the right solution is here, but Senator Johnson, I appreciate you bringing this forward. Senator Johnson, I'll give you the last word.
Thank you very much, members. I know this got to be a long discussion, but I think it's something that needs to be aired out over time. And it's part of a much larger issue that we have between the agencies and deer farms. I think, you know, if we focus back on the bill itself, this will just allow for our farmers to at least try to recover from the damage that was done in that those initial decisions, and allow us to continue that conversation going forward on what's best for our deer population, both wild and farmed across the state. So thank you very much for the time.
And Senator Johnson, Ms. Holtoss had her hand up a little while ago. Staff reminded me. And so, Ms. Holtoss, I want to give you the floor before we lay this bill over for possible consideration. If you wanted to respond to something.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll leave it very brief. Just reflecting on Mr. Porter's testimony as well, we are under strict guidelines when we move deer. We need to report to the Board of Animal Health when we want to move deer. And when we go into other states, we have to get confirmation from the other state that they will take our deer. So we can't just freely move deer wherever we want. We are under guidelines by the Minnesota Board of Animal Health and our associating states that take our deer. So we follow these guidelines to make sure and protect all deer farmers and the wild if we can, to make sure CWD is contained. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Holtoss. And members, there was talk about having an amendment to this bill. In the interest of time, we're going to just lay this over, but part of the language was to deal with the prior 2 years of a stop movement order, similar to the amendment language we passed out of here originally on the drought relief bill. So there is similar language to that, as Senator Johnson, as you continue to work on this, as our omnibus bill moves forward, any language like that could be worked on. But I just wanted to make mention of that as far as today goes. But we'll lay the bill over as discussed, for possible inclusion in the Ag Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Senator Johnson.
Thank you.
And thank you to the testifiers. We really appreciate you taking the time to come and join us here today. So
thanks for having us.
Thank you, Senator.
And members, Senator Dornick, we're getting ourselves a little tight on time, but I think Senator Dornick and Senator Murphy are able to help march right through our agenda. So Senator Dornick.
Mr. Chair.
Want to move your bill for possible for consideration and possible consideration in the Ag Omnibus Bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, there is an amendment. There's an A1 amendment.
And okay, Senator Dornick, why don't we introduce and discuss your bill briefly? I think that would be helpful as before we go to the A1 amendment.
Sure.
Just so everybody has the context of your bill. Why don't you identify that? Feel free to kind of weave in what your discussion for the amendment will be, and then we'll just move that afterwards after your testifier can share their input as well.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Go ahead, Senator Dorn.
Senate File 4118, this bill would exempt more licensed grain buyers from the requirements to file a bond and submit annual financial statements to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Under current law, grain buyers who purchase less than $100,000 of grain annually and pay upon delivery are exempt from these requirements. This bill simply increases that threshold to $250,000. So I do have a testifier also, Laura Lemke.
Ms. Lemke, identify yourself for the record. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Laura Lemke. I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. We are a 115-year-old organization that represents the interests of the grain elevator and feed mill industry in Minnesota. I'm here today to speak in support of Senate File 4118. When the grain buyer statute was changed a couple of years ago, we anticipated that there would likely be modifications needed down the road, and it seems like that time is now. Currently, the statute states that if a grain buyer's gross annual purchases are $100,000 or less, and purchases are made with cash or cash equivalent, they need neither a grain bond nor do they need to submit financial statements to the state. With the current state of grain prices, corn being $7 a bushel, soybeans in that $16 to $17 range, and wheat is $10 to $12 a bushel today, grain buyers purchasing grain at pre-2021 levels or prices are now dealing with some added expenses to be a grain buyer in Minnesota. The very small grain buyer who was at that $100,000 level is now required to obtain a grain bond or an irrevocable letter of credit and submit a financial review to the state, which costs on average anywhere between $5,000 to $10,000 or more, depending on the size and the complexity of the client. Not only have these smaller operators expressed concern about the financial burden that these requirements place solely on them, but some have had a difficult time finding a CPA firm who is knowledgeable about the grain business and can perform a CPA review. In regards to the amendment, do you want me to talk about that now or wait?
You know, Ms. Lemke, why don't you talk about it now? We will, just knowing that part of the discussion, we'll then move it later. I guess actually, you know what, why don't we just move the A1 amendment? Senator Dornick will move the A1 amendment to Senate File 4118. Go ahead, Ms. Lemke, why don't you talk about the A1 amendment and the reason you're supporting that or asking for that?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the A1 amendment is an increase from the $5 million threshold that grain purchasers are subject to now. It raises that $5 million threshold to $7.5 million. So in regards to small and medium-sized grain elevators, that $5 million threshold is what they're dealing with right now. Prior to and just after the law change, grain elevators that were flirting with that $5 million line were saying that, hey, I'm just going to stop buying grain when I get close to that number. And that's no way to operate an elevator because it stifles the business growth and it harms the local elevator's ability to properly service the farmers in their area. Other facilities frustrated by the increasing regulations have expressed that they would rather quit the business then put up with more regulations and added expense. About a year ago, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture estimated that the split between facilities over and under that $5 million threshold was about 50%. With today's grain prices, that split is closer to 2/3 or 3/4 of facilities being over the $5 million line. And that pushes them into full audit territory. The MGFA feels that an increase of the threshold from $5 million to $7.5 million would help alleviate some of the pressure on these smaller elevators and perhaps move us back to a more reasonable 50-50 split for facilities. Thank you, and if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Questions, members, to the A1 amendment? So, Ms. Lemke, can you repeat that statistic you gave us? I was distracted for part of it, so I'd be interested to have you restate that if you could, please.
Mr. Chairman, do you mean the stat from MDA on the over-under on the $5 million line?
Yes, yes.
So the Department of Agriculture said about a year ago that about 50% of licensed facilities in Minnesota were over the $5 million line and 50% were under. And today with our grain prices, we're looking at more like 2/3 to 3/4 of all licensed facilities being over the $5 million line.
So Ms. Lemke, do you know what $7,500 would do for those facilities? Does that go back to 50-50 or 60-40 or what, if you have any idea?
Mr. Chairman, I do not have a hard number for you. The thought is that $7.5 million would bring us closer to the 50-50 line than, you know, 2/3 to 3/4.
Somebody from MDA is here. We're going to... somebody from MDA have an answer to that, or are we putting you on the spot? I'm not trying to. Commissioner. Okay. Commissioner, you made the effort to come. We're happy to at least have you at the testifier table. Unlike some of your counterparts, Commissioner, any answer to that, and maybe just a comment on the bill while you're here, we'd appreciate that, and the amendment, I guess, in front of us.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, Tom Peterson, Commissioner, Department of Agriculture. We're checking on that, and sorry we didn't have our grain person available today. Not sure on that. We can get back to you on that. And then just to the bill in general, I think that this is something that we can support. The bill itself impacts a few. I think it was, we were looking somewhere like 15 or so of the 313 licensed facilities. So we think it's something we can work with Senator Dornick on as we move forward on. So we'll continue to work with you on this, but I think it's something that we can work with. So,
and Commissioner, when you say 15, is that on the lower end if we raise the threshold from 100,000 to 250?
Exactly.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And Commissioner, just for us, while we have you here, Ms. Lemke, these buyers are ones that they're paying cash to the farmer as they're delivering the crop and not going on credit. And so, Commissioner, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. If you have any comment on that, otherwise, Ms. Lemke or Senator Dornick, but Ms. Lemke can maybe add in back to just the original bill, raising the 100,000 level to the 250. Are we understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, the buyers at that $100,000 level right now, they're not required to have a bond. They're not required to submit financials to the state of Minnesota. But because of the increased grain prices, they are pushed beyond $100,000 worth of purchases. And now they are subject to the rules like any other grain buyer. They're beyond $100,000. Now they need to get a grain bond. Now they have to submit. In this case, they're likely under that $5 million number. So then they'd have to do a review.
Okay. So members to the A1 amendment, first of all, any other discussion? Members, I'm still trying to evaluate this myself, but I hear the concern. As you recall, some of what led to some of these levels was the elevator in my district, Ashby, a few years ago. Several farmers were out quite a bit of money. We've heard of others. So this is the balance that we need to try to find here. And so, Senator Dornick, I appreciate you bringing this forward. Our elevators are very important to us. Our farmers need that active market close to home. And so we're trying to find the best a balance that we can. So members, I guess I'd be interested to whatever you think on this, and we're going to lay this bill over either way. Any other discussion on this amendment? All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. So, Senator Daines.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lemke, could you tell me, a lot of times farmers take grain in the fall when they harvest it and they put it on a delayed payment program, and usually that's for tax reasons, so they delay that payment maybe into January, February. Is that considered to still be the owner of the grain, the person that brought the grain in, is he still considered to be the owner under that circumstance? Or is this considered to be in the care, custody, and control of the elevator, therefore this would be that bushelage would be charged against this 100,000 or 250 or whatever. Could you explain how that works?
Ms. Lemke?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Deems, if we are talking about just the small grain buyer at $100,000, a lot of those folks, they're not storing grain. They are buying it and shipping it right away. They're not keeping possession of it, and that's part of the benefit that they realize by being at the $100,000 level, they're not keeping the grain, they're not warehousing it, they're not keeping the grain. It's moving on, and they're paying cash to their buyer right away.
Follow up, Senator Mr. Chair. So let's assume that you have somebody that's over that number of bushels then, and that they are doing deferred payments. Whose ownership is that grain in when the person brought it into the elevator, he delivers it, he gets a receipt for the number of bushels, and he doesn't take payment maybe until February 1st, and something happens to that in between? Who's going to be responsible for that grain?
Ms. Lemke.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dames, in a situation like that, that becomes a grain buyer and warehouse situation where the facility would need a bond. And if that producer has contracted their grain, most likely they're contracting it for future pricing, that would fall under a voluntary extension of credit contract. That means that producer no longer technically owns that grain. It just hasn't been priced. And that producer has essentially given credit to the elevator. If the elevator fails between the time the grain was delivered and the time it was supposed to be paid for, then we run into the bond situation. We would be looking at receipted grain in order to try and make people whole selling that, as well as the grain bond. And if we're, again, hypothetically, if we're looking at a facility that is over $100,000 worth of purchases but under $5 million, we're looking at that small to mid-sized grain elevator. Have I answered your question, Senator Dames?
Not really, but that's all right.
Sorry.
So, Ms. Lemke, I'm going to follow up on that, though, because I think you bring up a good point. So somebody buying $100,000 worth of grain or less, you said they're getting rid of it right away. Might it be, just to give us some examples, might it be a feed mill that's, you know, buying 2,000 bushels of corn and then grinding it up, selling it to livestock farmers that they have as customers? Or, I mean, $100,000 in grain today would be, you know, less than 15,000 bushels of corn total, or about that, 20 for sure. Give us an idea of these smaller operators, and we're talking the whole year, 100,000 total all year, so less than $10,000 a month of purchases, but they're paying cash as the customer brings the grain in, so the next day, if they go broke, the farmer still has their cash and money from their delivery. That's kind of who we're talking about on this low end, right?
Mr. Chairman, yes. And absolutely, it could be a small feed mill. It could be a small farmer, even, really, buying a certain amount of grain, paying cash for it, and turn around and feeding it to his own livestock.
Sure. So, Ms. Lemke, is there a difference then of an elevator that might do less than $100,000, but they pay cash to some customers and they take care and custody of other grain and warehouse it for a month or two before that farmer decides to sell it? Is that a difference? Are we talking two different entities here, or both of them exempt if they're under $100,000 in current law?
Mr. Chairman, I do not know of any grain elevators in Minnesota that purchase less than $100,000 worth of grain that would qualify, that would fit in this definition that you're putting out there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Other questions, members? Senator French, do you have any? Okay. I don't think we have any further questions. Members, Senator Dornick, was there anybody else you had to testify? I don't believe so. Senator Dornick, give us final acts comment, and then we'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Commissioner Peterson and Laura Lemke for testifying, my co-author, Senator Goggin, and you and the members for hearing Senate File 4118. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Dornick. This bill is laid over as amended. Next, Senator Murphy. What's the Senate File? Senate File 4184. Senator Murphy moved Senate File 4184 for consideration and possible inclusion in the Ag Omnibus Bill. Senator Murphy, sorry we're getting short of time. We will give you as much indulgence as we can possibly squeeze out of our time and a little after. So tell us about your bill, and then we'll move to your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 4184 is a very modest proposal that will yield strong dividends for the state of Minnesota. I think that it is important for us to understand the emergence of local and regional food systems. And with $10,000, we can do an analysis of that, sharpen our focus, and take full advantage of this emerging part of Minnesota's agriculture system. This will serve us in many ways, but primarily, it will strengthen our relationship with local farmers, will bring economic vitality for the state of Minnesota, and by understanding local and regional food markets, we will further the health of the people of Minnesota. It is a good bill, and with that, I'll turn this over to my testifiers.
Very good. Julia Wickham, welcome from the Farmers Union. Identify yourself for the record. You may proceed, and then we have one more testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julia Wickham. I'm the legislative coordinator at the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I'm here to share our support for Senator Murphy's bill on additional funding for local and regional food system reporting. Last growing season, I worked on a small family farm in southeastern Minnesota near Wabasha, and I'll be returning as soon as session is over. We grew organic vegetables and provided produce for nearly 80 families through our CSA program, and then also many more at the farmers market that we attended in the Twin Cities. I also worked for a nonprofit in Minneapolis and St. Paul that focused on land access for urban growers. So in that work, I've had a lot of conversations with farmers and growers on the importance of effectively and efficiently selling their products to local communities. This bill would be a really great investment for our local regional food system and give additional research and reporting on how to sell those products to local markets. And it could come at a really important time. COVID disrupted our largely consolidated food system and showed the food supply chains were vulnerable to breakdowns and bottlenecks. This created both challenges and a lot of opportunities for producers who sell into those local and regional markets. Our members at the Minnesota Farmers Union are really excited to take lessons from the pandemic and apply them to making our food system more resilient. So this study could support data-informed growth for farmers and producers, allowing them to grow their business and meet the needs of consumers, as well as assist your committee in all the really great work you do. So thank you again to Senator Murphy and to you, Mr. Chair, and all members on the committee for the work that you're doing. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Wickham. We'll go to the next testifier and then open up for questions. I understand Ms. Kathy Zeman is joining us by Zoom. Kathy, are you there?
I am. Can
welcome,
you hear me?
Welcome. Okay. Identify yourself for the record, and thank you for joining us. You may proceed.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Westrom, Senator Murphy, and members of the Senate Committee. I am Kathy Zeman, the Executive Director with the Minnesota Farmers Market Association, and I'm Zooming in to you today from my farm office in rural Rice County. The Minnesota Farmers Market Association is the home to 350-plus farmers markets scattered in all 87 counties and tribal nations in Minnesota. We have about 5 to 5,500 vendors at all of those markets as well. MFMA advocates for anything that'll build out our local food shed in order to increase our resiliency in our local food shed. And we provide a lot of training on all the different entities and topics that our farmers markets and vendors need. Before I go to talk to the support of Senator Murphy's bill to increase funding for the local and regional food system reporting, I would like to take a moment just to say thank you to you, MDA, and all the other state departments that helped keep the Minnesota farmers markets open during the pandemic. It didn't happen in many other states, and we were very thankful to you for your leadership and your support, so I wanted to make sure that we told you that today. I am testifying today, though, to strongly support Senate File 4184. In Minnesota right now, we've got several efforts going on to collect data. And at MFMA, we're fundraising to get FM360. It's a metrics project for all of the farmers markets. The MDA and the University of Minnesota has their statewide cooperative partnership, three-year grant project, of which MFMA is one of the 40-plus organizations helping to support. Both of those are metrics collection efforts. Both of those are in vertical silos of information that don't have horizontal bridges between them. Ours is looking at farmers market. The statewide cooperative partnership is looking at really MDA programs, both the produce safety and the Minnesota growing. Neither of them are looking at all the assets that are scattered throughout the state that we know about. And then none of us are looking at all the gaps that we need to fill in the local food shed. And that's what this bill could do. That's what this reporting system could do, would finally surround everything that we've got and everything that we're missing. And that would allow you to make wise decisions on the investment of public dollars in the local food shed. So on behalf of everyone here at the Minnesota Farmers Market Association, thank you to your committee and especially to Senator Murphy for putting this bill forward, which we hope you will support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Zeman. Members, questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the last testifier said there's like 650 food markets or something like that. I'm just wondering how many regions we have in the state that the 650 fit into as far as local food markets. Anybody have?
Ms. Zeman?
Thank you, Senator Westerman, Senator Anderson. We have 350, of which most of them are scattered in the bottom two-thirds of Minnesota, and then the rest are kind of trickled out of that northern third. And I was referring to farmers markets. There's 350 farmers markets in the state of Minnesota.
350 farmers markets, okay. How many regions are there?
Senator Anderson, Ms. Zeman? How many regions do we have, if you know?
How's the state broken up?
We don't break them up really into any regions. They're just scattered throughout the state. There are no regions. As far as the farmers markets go.
Senator Anderson, any follow-up?
Oh, Mr. Chair, the language says state of regional and local food systems. That's why I'm asking about regional. If we're if it's just going to be local food systems, like the 350 that Ms. Zeman mentioned, or is it going to be like we have 10 judicial districts within the state, is that considered a region, and how is that broken up?
Good question. Senator Murphy, any comment on that, or Ms. Zeman?
This is Kathy Zeman. I could answer that in some ways. So in that case, there are hundreds probably of regional food systems. Like you would consider the food hub with the Good Acre would be one regional system because they pull in from the metro. The food hub at Little Falls, Sprout, would be a regional food system. There's regional food systems around any of the co-ops. So in that context, there are probably 100 regional food systems in the state that we would need to surround and try to figure out. And that's part of why this report needs to be done, right? Is because we don't know where all the community food hubs are. We don't know where all the community kitchens are. We don't know where all those assets are. And we don't know where they're needed.
And Ms. Zeman, to that question and to that point, I was going to ask the follow-up question of to this bill, and what would we exactly get in this report? If you want to, I'm trying to, you know, just make the connection of what's the tangible, what is it, when this is done, what will it leapfrog us into, be able to do or know or better have developed markets or return result in more opportunity or discover things that we don't know. If you can add that, I think, to Senator Anderson's question, and then Senator Murphy, if you have any comment on that. But Ms. Zeman, I'll let you go first.
If I could rule the world, what this report would give us would be a look at the USDA does a great job of tracking what the Farm Bill supports, right? The USDA has no capacity to look at Little Ag, the local food shed, because it's not in their purview. That's what this report could do. This report could finally look at what is going on in the local food shed. For instance, we have a lot of data right now that suggests that the economic impact at the 350 farmers markets in the state are coming close to $150 million. Now, we don't have any real institutional survey to prove that. This report could help us get to that kind of data collection. And that's only at the farmers market level. We don't have any of that data for direct marketing farmers either, right? If we had some of that, we would know exactly where we need all of our meat lockers. We would know exactly where we need all of our community food hubs. We would know, if we would have had this survey done and some work done 5 years ago, COVID-19 wouldn't have harmed the food shed quite as much as it did. And in COVID-19, remember, the short supply food chains held, those long ones broke, and that's where we ran into trouble. That's what this kind of a report can do. It can give us that kind of information. Where do we have our assets to build out the resiliency in our communities, community food hubs, community kitchens, where we need meat lockers, where we need more processing plants? How do we develop the economic impact? How do we capture that? Is there so much that we don't know? I mean, we know a lot, but there's so much we don't know, and that's what this report could do.
Mr. Chair, and very good. Senator Anderson, if I may, your question.
Go ahead.
Kathy Zeman said it beautifully. And just to reiterate, it would be, you know, data from the wonderful programs that MDA is doing compiled into one place, and then, you know, 3 to 5 metrics on how to measure this, the local and regional food system. So to your question, Senator Anderson, we need metrics and measurements, like you said, like what is a region in our food system. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wickham. And Commissioner Peterson, we call you back up for any additional comment on this, if you could offer as well.
Mr. Chairman and members, appreciate the opportunity to just comment on behalf of the department. And apologies to Senator Murphy, haven't had a chance to visit with you about this. Our department hasn't. We definitely see merit in this study and everything. Just a couple of quick thoughts on it. We are trying to assess how this would interact with a current proposal we have, our statewide cooperative partnership for local food and regional markets that Ms. Zeman mentioned. And I think that we just want to would want to coordinate, not sure we're overlapping, or see if there was a way to put it in with that, because we're not sure like which staff person or how would work with this. So if this were to pass, we may consider putting out like a RFP and having somebody else do it from the department. And then also just would have to look at the dollar amount for doing this, like 10,000. And it's always hard when you look at studies, because it sounds like a lot of money, but it may not be enough money. Our staff thought something like this might be more in the $25,000 to $40,000 range, depending on how much you wanted to. You know, I always say with reports, because we do a lot of reports, you do a $10,000 appropriation for a report, you get a $10,000 report. You do a $50,000 report, you get a $50,000 report. So, if that makes sense. But just again, just their merit with it, but just a couple of comments we wanted to make on this. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner Peterson. Other questions, members? Senator Murphy, you get the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this.
Go ahead.
This modest proposal. It is a good bill. I hope that we will lay it over for inclusion. Thank you.
Brevity. Thank you, Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chair, she sounds like Tomasoni.
That's a big compliment.
Big shoes to fill, actually, but that is a compliment. Senator Murphy lays over Senate File 4180.
4184.
Senate File 4118 for possible inclusion in the Ag Omnibus Bill. Thank you. Members, that concludes our agenda. Thank you for good participation. I think we had a lot of good information today, and thank everybody that came afar and nearby to participate in our committee, make agriculture this Ag Week. Members, it's a National Ag Week, so very appropriate. Everything we do here to keep agriculture strong and vibrant and feed our state and build a strong economy, we should be proud of that. So with that, no further business. This meeting is adjourned.